Today we're hearing three highlights from the New Yorker Festival, and now I'll turn things over to my colleague, Kelly Fasano.
What?
So is this it? We're doing this?
Yeah, let's just do it. Let's do it.
Wait, they gave me this thing to read.
Oh, you're going to welcome everybody?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to let you do your thing.
Okay, I'm going to do my thing.
Okay.
Hi. My name is Kelly Fasano. I'm a staff writer here at the New Yorker Magazine. I'm here with Marc Maron.
Thank you.
Just in case anyone doesn't know, he's been doing stand-up since the 1980s. He's Ooh. Had two one-person shows, one of which the New Yorker described as heartbreakingly funny, the other of which the New Yorker did not review.
I don't even know which one that one was.
He has Maron, a TV show that's done three seasons so far on IFC.
Yeah.
He's written a book, and as a few of you might be aware, written two books, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
And as a few of you might be aware, starting in 2009 and continuing to this moment and onward into the future, he has recorded 642 episodes of WTF
Thank
with Marc
you.
Maron.
Thank you. Yes, that's all true.
It's all true. So
I can validate all of that.
642 episodes.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Are you getting better?
I think I am getting better because I don't talk as much during it. I think I listen better, and I think I'm a lot more emotionally engaged. I mean, I'm crying for almost no reason. Like, people come and I'm crying already. And they're like, this is an interesting way to start an interview. And I'll just say, well, this is how it's going to go now.
there's a story from one of, I can't remember, I think it might be in one of your books, where you come off stage and someone says to you, why comedy?
Yeah. Man, that guy, I was, at that time, that was in the 80s. Maybe 87, 88, and I was very aggressive. I was angry. It was not, you know, it was not necessarily everyone's idea of a nice evening out. And I just done this set at Stitches. I remember it in Boston. And I just done this set, and I was pretty happy with it. And some dude just walked up to me, and he's like, "What? Why comedy?" And I could not answer him. I don't think I could answer him now, really. I thought that what I was doing was perfectly fine for comedy. I think laughs were an essential.
well, that's...
It was impact.
But you've often talked about this, right? That you weren't necessarily driven by this desire to entertain. And somewhere along the way, you realized, oh, wait, this is supposed to be part of the job description. Like, I'm supposed to entertain people, or people yeah. expect me to entertain them.
Yeah, I always, like, kind of... I would always rationalize that by, if I'm not entertaining, I'll be compelling. I mean, I can be compelling. Like, if I'm on stage, you're not going to be like, this is boring. You know what I mean? Like, I'll be sweating. I'll be doing something. But I don't think I got into it to be an entertainer. I got into it to be a comic. Like, a stand-up comic to me, in my mind, it wasn't an entertainer's position. It was some sort of strange, noble, truth-telling place. I didn't think of it as an entertainer. I thought they were important people that did important thinking.
Did you think of, but was making people laugh? I mean, how does that figure in?
I knew that was part of it. I'm not a moron. I mean, like, I wasn't like, I'm going to reinvent stand-up comedy so it's not funny. That wasn't my agenda. But I just thought that in my mind, performing stand-up comedy was you could do whatever you want if the context was comedy. So I knew I had to get laughs. I wanted to be funny. I believe I was funny. I think I'm funnier now. But I knew you could do whatever you wanted up there. And to me, it was a place to figure out who I was, to figure out the parameters of the stage, to figure out how far I could push people, to basically get the parenting I didn't get. I was going to drag people through my shitty childhood for as long as it took for them to accept me, and then I tell them to fuck off.
One of the continuing narratives on your show is, and one of the things that I love, is when you get a young comedian on the podcast who has achieved some success and hasn't gone through 10 years, 20 years of hell on the road and in these comedy clubs. And there's a special skepticism that you bring out when you talk to comedians like that.
It's a nice way to put it.
Do you think it's important that comedians go through that same kind of of suffering, of tough rooms.
But outside of suffering, is it important for any creative person to pay their dues and figure out who they are before, you know, we're dragged through their success? So
when you say we're dragged through, you mean as fans?
Whatever you want to call it. And back when I start, God, am I that guy now? Back in the day, you can only do comedy at a comedy club. So you have to wait around and you have to wait for their dumb open mic. Now anyone who's been on stage for 7 minutes is like, I'm doing comedy. No, you're not. You're not. You're some guy that went on stage for five. Do I take it as an insult to what I do as a comic? Fuck yes, I do. You know, do I have to shut my mouth about that generally? Kinda. I'm happy if people are, you know, like, you know, taking improv classes so they can, you know, be around people better. I'm happy if you know, experiment all you want. But it's like, you know, I'm a guy that committed to it. So if somebody's sitting before me and they don't treat it with the respect that a lifer has for it, then fuck them on some level. They can try to talk me out of it. And a lot of guys turn out to be, you know, geniuses, and they're great, and I love them. And sometimes what you're hearing is not so much skepticism about a lifestyle. It's just old guy jealousy. So it's just like anything else, dude. You know, as a lifer, it's hard to hear someone disrespect it or take it for granted.
Part of what goes on in comedy and has always gone on is that when someone achieves a certain amount of success in stand-up, there's an industry that wants to take them from stand-up and have them do something else.
I've been fortunate to avoid that. So,
well, sort of. Of all the things, right, when you record that first episode, I think it was with Jeffrey Ross on the phone, right?
Yeah.
Of all the things that went through your head, I can't imagine that one of them was, this thing might become so successful that I become slightly jealous of my own podcast. Right? I mean, that's pretty insane.
Yeah.
What were, like...
I'm still trying to wrap my brain around that. Yeah. Yeah, it is insane. I think at the beginning, I had no idea what we were up to. I just knew I needed to keep doing something, and that I liked radio a lot, and that for some reason, whatever I did on those mics connected. I don't know what that was, but I knew it from when I did talk radio. Like, I would go, like, there was this thing once, I remember the time that it happened, where, like, we were doing political talk radio at 6 in the morning on Air America, and because we had to do news, I had to get up at like 2:30 or 3 in the morning because it takes a lot for me to wrap my brain around that, you know? So we just spent 4 hours, you know, trying to get this news together and, you know, focusing my anger on stuff. Right around the Republican National Convention in 2004, like the night before, I decided to trap 5 feral cats and bring them into my house. And it became so much more important than politics. And I was so relieved by it. So I started talking about the cats, and then I started talking about, like, one time I let lentils cook too long, and it created this sort of weird tar-like substance, and and I just was aggressively going through it because I would drink like 2 Dunkin' Donuts coffee, and I eat all these M&Ms, and I just like rambled on for 15 minutes about lentil tar, and my cats. And I started getting these emails like, that was the most compelling shit I ever heard. I don't know what you were talking about, but man, I was in. And I'm like, whoa, maybe I got something with this thing. So that was what was going on with that. Like, I didn't know what that show was, but I loved the medium. I liked audio, and it's a gift, you know, to be good at something that you didn't expect. And even if with all my speech impediments, my dumb stuttering, you know, like, there's something that still comes through. I don't know why, but I loved it, and I didn't know what the show would be then. I certainly didn't know at that time. You know, I was desperate. I was desperate.
But the format didn't change that much, right? I mean, it was it kind of from the start was you talking a little bit into the microphone and then having a conversation with a person.
Have people around. Because when you do morning radio and you got a crew, there's nothing better than that. There's nothing more exciting than doing live morning radio with a bunch of people in the room. Like, you know, it's easy to condescend, and I've done it myself. But a good morning crew, that's a big job. You got to hold an audience who don't want to be awake. And they're probably going someplace that they don't want to go to, and their life is not what they planned. And you're sitting there going, how's everybody doing out there? Here we go. It's a hell of a job. But I needed people around. I needed people to laugh. I needed to be able to look at somebody. The day I learned how to talk on a microphone alone was one of the best days of my life. You know who's the best at that? Rush Limbaugh. Now, like, I don't like to admit that, but, you know, as a radio guy, you know, you listen to that guy pause, and I don't like listening to him, you know. I don't like it as much as any liberal who listens to Rush Limbaugh. You kind of like it because it makes you go, aah! So, I think 25% of his listeners are liberals going, that f***er! So that's a pretty compelling personality. But the day that I learned how to do that, just talking freely to nobody, alone, in my garage, and it was comfortable, I was like, this is it. I freed myself, and I became a broadcaster in my mind. And then it just became the conversations, because, you know, I needed to talk.
And when did you realize that people were coming to your stand-up because they liked WTF?
Well, that took a while. You know, I mean, we could see the numbers. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see how many people download your thing. You know, and I was aware that, you know, that if I talked to somebody who was a big celebrity, that, you know, we bring people to it. I'm not going to pretend like, oh, who knew that Robin Williams would, you know, like, so there was, you know, there were definitely people that I struggled to get. It was not easy to book necessarily because no one knew what a podcast was. And a lot of people were like, no, I guess Maron's kind of hit the bottom. I always liked the guy. I'm going to go, I'll help him out. Like, I don't think Louis C.K. had any idea that anyone was going to listen to that thing at all.
Which is part of what made that so intense. Should we play a little clip from you having a conversation with Louis C.K.?
It always hurts me a little, but yeah.
I could have used you. I got divorced. I got a show canceled. You know, I had some tough times. I could have used a friend.
But you didn't.
Those times that were making you jealous. I was struggling. I was having a hard time.
But
doing the Louis show was really hard. Trying to keep my family together was hard.
But the thing is that in the way our friendship always operated, it was not that I was kept up to date in the day-to-day things. It wasn't a day-to-day call that we had. But it seemed that most of the time, the thing that made our friendship so deep and so strong was that when we did talk, we made each other feel better.
No, it's true. But you shut me out. You shut me out because you were having a hard time.
Okay. I apologize again.
Well, I apologize to you because I did it to you probably out of resentment.
Ignored
your emails because you ignored my phone calls back when there was no email.
Can we get back on track or what?
Yeah, I think we can.
I think that's the first time I noticed he said that. That you ignored my phone calls back before there was no email? Is that what he said? When was that? The worst part about hearing that is but. I just can't handle that. But no, let me just try and smooth this over. This can't be this bad.
Well, but that's when, I mean, in theory, right, this is like two comics talking about comedy. In practice, this is nothing like that at all, right? This is the kind of conversation we never get to hear in any context. And yeah. Even if you don't care at all about comedy, I think anyone would find that compelling.
No, I agree. I never set out to do a Making the Sausage podcast. I mean, that's just a way to get somewhere else. I have a great deal, like, comics, like, all they do is sit around and think all day. That's their job. There's very few things they can't speak to. Well, most of them are pretty intelligent people. Some of them are incredibly sensitive, most of them. They're like, you know, they're philosophers, they're poets, they're people that live life in a way. They're not great, obviously, you know, emotionally and with relationships all the time. But I never set out to make a sausage-making podcast, so it never struck me that Louis and I were going to talk about comedy. I thought I had a very personal take on Louis' career because I saw some of the stuff that I experienced with him as being defining And it was. And then it went this other direction. And we're good now. I mean, it was a good conversation. We're very close now. Like, you know, he texts me a lot, and we were talking a lot for a while, and now he's busy, I guess. I'm busy too, but like, I get texts. You know, he'll be like, how you doing, pal? Be a pretty good buddy, you? I'm good. That's good. Love you, man. Love you too, buddy. We do that. But I could text him right now, and he'd probably respond to me.
Let's put that to the test.
Go ahead.
Was there a point where you started realizing that these conversations were having an effect on your life, were shaping your life, the conversations that you were having in your garage?
Yes. Are you kidding me? Oh, I just wrote he, pal. All right, let's see what happens. I wonder if that's the right number. Look, you know, I need to talk. It's the way I process things. I'm not good at processing without talking to people. And when I started the podcast, when I moved to Los Angeles, it was not good with me. You know, I was darkly depressed. I was severely heartbroken. I was incredibly bitter. But I needed to talk to people to reintegrate myself with my friends, to reintegrate myself with the community of artists, which I'm wary to use that word. But, you know, the community of comedians, artists is a weird word to me. I don't know why. I don't know why. I don't like calling myself an artist. I'm a comedian. So, whatever. See, like right now, who am I arguing with? You see what happens if I'm not talking to somebody else? Okay. So, there's also something within, say, recovery concept, actually. And I don't mind being public about that. But, you know, when you talk to somebody else, you get out of your own head. And it engages your empathy. It engages your compassion. It also is entertaining. You know, I had a very, you know, a very charismatic, fairly, you know, emotionally dangerous father. But like, he was very compelling. And I spent my life, you know, seeking out, you know, charismatic people to sort of like just use as a battery. You know what I mean? Like I like to be entertained. I like when people are engaging. I like to be engaged. And so I think like the first 100 or so podcasts were really just me inviting famous people over to help me with my problems and to sort of glean some of that energy. And I love it.
One of the questions that you answered on the show this year is the question of who is harder to book, Lorne Michaels or the President of the United States?
Turns out the president is easier to book.
Turns out the president easier to book than Lorne Michaels. Let's roll the clip of Obama, and then we'll take some questions from the audience.
Listen, I'm a big fan, and you know, I love conversations like this because, you know, if I thought to myself that when I was in college that I'd be in a garage,
yeah,
a couple miles away from where I was living, doing an interview
as president
with a comedian. I think that's a pretty hard scenario to...
Couldn't imagine it.
It's not possible to imagine.
No.
Just deflected it is the not, hit. No, nobody could imagine. So that's fun.
Well, yeah. And I'm also like, you know, I pay it. I don't, you know, there was a period where I was a little more attentive politically, where I, right. You know, I ran the country from my couch for a couple of years.
A lot of people do. Yeah, I hear from them all the time. You idiot! Why aren't you doing it this way?
Yeah. I heard from them this morning. I got nothing but emails from people telling me what I got to say to you.
Unbelievable! It's a big day. It's a true honor that was. Like, I can't even quite wrap my brain around it because, you know, people. You know, a few people who interviewed me around that, they said, so are you going to be interviewing, you know, candidates? I'm like, no. I interviewed the president. Why would I interview those people? When they're president, I'll interview them. President asked me to talk to him. What an amazing day.
So if you've got a question, line up at the microphone. And
this guy's ready.
He's ready.
Hi, Mark. My name is Roy. How are you?
Roy. Good, man. What's up?
A little more about President Obama.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have a president, a guy in a suit. You had Obama.
Yeah.
And love or like or not like his politics, he's a bright guy. He's the first black president in our country. Mm. When he left and the Secret Service left and they were all gone and it was just you in the studio, what was going through your head?
It was me and Brendan, and I cried.
I knew it.
Comedian and podcast impresario Mark Maron talking with The New Yorker's Khelif Hassani. At newyorkerradio.org, you can find that interview with Lorne Michaels, the legendary head of Saturday Night Live, episode 653 of Maron's podcast, WTF.